Okay, good evening and welcome to One and All. Pleasure to have the opportunity to do a little learning with you tonight. Just to bring everyone up to speed, last week, and if you've missed a session, you can find them all online, but last week we suggested five explanations that contribute to our understanding of how it is that the Shulchan Aruch became the enduring code of Jewish law for the Jewish people. And in some ways, this evening's session is a kind of postscript to that discussion. Okay, for a number of decades after its publication, as we discussed, the question of the Shulchan Aruch's authority was not entirely settled. And we saw all kinds of critiques from contemporaries and successors of Rabbi Yosef Karo at the end of the 16th and beginning of the 17th century. The book and the codification, the idea of codification, generated all kinds of opposition and controversy. But let's say by the middle of the 17th century, it seems that a lot, maybe most of the dust had settled, and the Shulchan Aruch had emerged as a text of singular import. And it's here in the 17th century that I want to pick up our story this evening. Okay. And I've titled this class "The Cataclysms of the 17th Century and the Poskim." Looming large, okay, are two dates which we're going to come back to often over the course of this session. 1648, 1649, the Chmelnytsky massacres, and 1666, the declaration of Shabtai Tzvi's messiahship. Okay, so just kind of park those dates in the back of your mind. So what happens in the middle of the 17th century is that a number of very important scholars begin writing commentaries to the Shulchan Aruch. So again, Reb Moshe Isserles, who's functionally a contemporary, wrote and included his glosses in the text of the Shulchan Aruch, and that was one explanation that we mentioned last week that surely contributed in a major way to the notion of the Shulchan Aruch as a singular text, because it was representing not only the Sephardic tradition but also now the Ashkenazic tradition. So everyone had a voice in this new unified code. Maybe the first commentary to be written to the Shulchan Aruch, quote unquote, which includes both the work of Reb Yosef Karo and Reb Moshe Isserles, probably the first was a commentary by a man called Reb Yeshua Falk HaKohen, not to be confused with someone who lived about a century later, who was known as the Pnei Yeshua and had the same name. But Reb Yeshua Falk HaKohen, who died in 1614, published a book called the Me'iras Einayim, Sefer Me'iras Einayim, which was known by its Rosh Tevos as the Sma. It was a commentary to the Choshen Mishpat section of Shulchan Aruch, and it was groundbreaking and still appears in many print editions of the Shulchan Aruch. It was very, very important. There was a second work by an author we know very little about called the Ateres Tzvi, and for reasons we won't get into tonight, ended up not being accepted in any way, shape, or form, not really even studied in subsequent generations. Most people in a base medrash probably have not heard of the Ateres Tzvi, even though he was one of the earliest commentaries to the Shulchan Aruch. Okay, but tonight, I want to focus specifically on three individuals who were instrumental in cementing the reputation and centrality of the Shulchan Aruch. They're known affectionately by the names of their books, the Magen Avraham, the Taz, and the Shach. Okay, we hear these names bandied about all the time in halachic discussions. And tonight, I want to, at the very least, introduce you to them. Okay, each of them deserves their own treatment for sure. And maybe at another time, we'll have more opportunity to speak about each at length. But they, in some ways, form a kind of unit, and I wanted to talk about them together. I'll just share a quote for you from the Jewish Encyclopedia, which is really still relevant, even though it's written 120 years ago. You have it in source number two. Although all these men, right, these writers of commentaries, although all these men preserved a certain independence toward the work, they yet confirmed its authority, the Shulchan Aruch's authority, by making it the basis of their own works and by undertaking to explain it. And that's a kind of central motif around which I want to build our discussion tonight, the notion that it was these accumulating nosei kelim, as they're known, that made the Shulchan Aruch into into what it is. Again, we could have imagined an alternate reality as a result of the issues that we talked about last week, the effect of the Ramah and the Yad Hashem and the print revolution and so on. Those surely would have had and did have a major effect on the trajectory of the Shulchan Aruch, but something else happened a century later that really cemented its identity. And what happened is the focus of our discussion tonight, the publication of these commentaries by these extraordinary men. Okay, so the first that I want to talk about is the author of the Magen Avraham, a man called Rabbi Avraham Gambiner. Okay, and I'll just say by way of introduction that biographically we have almost nothing written about him. There's really a kind of yawning chasm between the place and the influence that he holds on the one hand in the pantheon of commentaries to the Shulchan Aruch and the biographical data that we have and the scholarship on him on the other. Okay, so usually, you know, people have targets on their back. If someone is that important in the course of Jewish history, so people are going to jump on him, they're going to study them, they're going to write about them, and we're going to know about them. And the Magen Avraham, for all of his fame, saying if you read the Mishnah Berurah, he's quoted on every page in Orach Chaim. His comments and his Piskei Halacha influence all aspects of day-to-day Jewish life, and yet the scholarship is almost nil. Okay, so it's difficult to piece together even kind of the basics about his background. We do know roughly that he was born in 1635 and he lived until 1682. The date of his death is known to us. He was born in a little loch in Poland called Gombin, you know, hence the family name. As I mentioned, you know, no one really escaped the Chmelnytsky massacres. We'll come back to them. We think of 1648, 1649 as the principal dates, but the rebellion, the uprising, the Cossack pogroms continued into the 1650s, and the parents of Rabbi Avraham Gambiner were martyred in Gombin by the Cossacks in 1655. Okay. As a young man, he became a dayan in Kalish. You could still find the town of Kalish. I think it's in present day Poland. And at the age of 30, he began writing his commentary to the Shulchan Aruch. Okay, so his commentary, again, there are four sections of the Shulchan Aruch. His commentary is exclusively on Orach Chaim. And Orach Chaim, right, covers day-to-day Jewish living. So that's the halachos of brachos and tefillah and kriyas shema and netilas yadayim and Shabbos and erevin and all the chagim. So his commentary has an impact on, you know, everything that we do kind of on a daily basis. There's one story that is almost surely apocryphal. I have it for you in source number 3. I'll just summarize it for you. Even though it's almost surely apocryphal, I'm sharing it for an important reason. The story is this. The story goes like this, that Rav Avraham Gambiner was so destitute and so dirt poor that he and his wife shared one pair of shoes. They shared one pair of shoes, and so as a result, they had to take turns going to shul on Shabbos. One week he would go, and one week she would go. And the story goes that the Taz, who was the Gadol Hador, and we're going to talk about him in a few minutes, the Taz came to visit their town. The Taz came to visit Kalish, okay, which is not in and of itself impossible. He was certainly alive and would have been in the neighborhood. And it happened to be the week where Mrs. Gambiner got to go to shul. So she goes to shul and she hears the drasha from the Taz, the visiting Gadol Hador. And after Shabbos, the Taz is leaving town on Sunday morning, whatever the case may be. And the Taz, the Magen Avraham, Avraham Gambiner, puts on his, you know, pair of shoes and he runs after the wagon carrying the Taz to, you know, say a word because the Gadol Hador visited town. And the Taz says to him, "I didn't see you in shul yesterday. You kind of missed the drasha." And the Magen Avraham explains why. He says, you know, we're so poor. We only had one pair of shoes. It was my wife's week. I couldn't be there. And they start talking and learning. And the Taz understands and recognizes that, you know, this is not just any person living in the community, but this is obviously a towering Torah personality, and arranges for him to have some kind of position, you know, teaching, and advances his career. So the reason why I share this story, even if it's not true, is that what almost surely was true is the sense that Avraham Gambiner lived a life of total deprivation and poverty. And this has an impact. This has an impact on his scholarship, because unlike, you know, some other contemporaries who we'll talk about soon, the Magen Avraham didn't have access to all the books that everyone had access to, because, you know, his library is very limited. He can't afford them. Books are expensive. He can't travel because he can't afford to travel to go to places where they have bigger libraries. And so there's this fascinating phenomenon, which is borne out in the course of the commentary of the Magen Avraham, which is that he relies on secondary sources, such as there's a book called the Knesset HaGedola, which is you know, tends to summarize a lot of the a lot of the earlier sources. So the Magen Avraham is using secondary sources without access to the primary sources. And again, it's a fascinating thing to notice when you study the libraries of Jewish scholars, to kind of just note, like, well, maybe they're saying X, Y, and Z because they didn't know A, B, and C, or they didn't have access to D, E, and F, because their library was particularly limited. Okay, so it's just a fascinating avenue to explore when thinking about the Magen Avraham and the limited access that he had to the scholarship, contemporary scholarship, and contemporary books. Okay, when he finished writing his book, it was 1671. Another consequence of his poverty is that he had sent his brother to publish the book. He's living in Poland, but the premier publishing center of the Jewish world in this generation is Amsterdam. It, a century earlier, it had been Venice. Now it's unquestionably Amsterdam. Everyone goes to Amsterdam, not just Jews, but everyone in the world goes to Amsterdam to publish their books. And he sends his brother to publish this commentary to Orach Chaim of the Shulchan Aruch. And his brother tries and he fails because he can't afford the cost of bringing this book to print. Okay. So it's not actually printed until after the lifetime of the Magen Avraham. Okay. I'll just add a couple quick notes about the Magen Avraham, to get a glimpse of what it is that he's doing in his commentary. First of all, after he published his book in 1671, he wrote the book. It wasn't published until after his death. So 10 years later, there was a man who could afford to publish his book, named Rabbi Shmuel Bar Yosef of Krakow, and he wrote a commentary to Orach Chaim called the Olas Tamid. Okay, and if you have source number 4, you can sort of get the history of this this book. The Olas Tamid came out, and people were so excited. It's a wonderful commentary to Orach Chaim. The Magen Avraham, in basically the last year of his life, went back and edited his own text to critique all the many problems and mistakes in the Olas Tamid. And when his book was published in 1692, it almost immediately supplanted the earlier published work. So no one's ever heard of the Olas Tamid. It sort of blew out of the water the competition and became the principal commentary to the Shulchan Aruch on Orach Chaim. Two things, or maybe just three quick points about the Magen Avraham before I pause and take any questions. One is the Magen Avraham made it his duty to defend Minhagim. Okay, I mentioned this in the context of the Ramah. If it was true about the Ramah defending Ashkenazic Minhagim, it's like true to another order of magnitude with respect to the Magen Avraham. Every line of the Magen Avraham, I'm exaggerating, but only a little, is he says, yeah, yeah, this is what the Shulchan Aruch writes, this is what the Ramah says, it's wonderful, it's beautiful, it's true, but don't forget the minhag that we have, the minhag that we know, the minhag that we do, right? He wants everyone to know about the minhagim that are not recorded in the Shulchan Aruch and Ramah, and he wants to and he wants his readers to understand their centrality and their importance. The next thing I'll say about the Magen Avraham is that he was a Kabbalist, and he introduced not an insignificant amount of Kabbalah into the halachic decision-making process, more than either the Shulchan Aruch or Ramah. And again, part of a larger discussion, but what ends up trickling down is now a discussion of the halachic process, which is informed much more heavily by Kabbalistic sources than we would have had absent the Magen Avraham. He writes very very succinctly, and again, this may have been because he couldn't afford the ink and paper, you know, literally or figuratively. But because he writes so succinctly, sometimes even cryptically, what's amazing is that over the course of the next century, his commentary generates super commentaries. A commentary to a text is called a commentary. A commentary to a commentary is called a super commentary. So amazingly, people, important people, begin writing commentaries to the Magen Avraham. Okay, so you're just trying to learn the Shulchan Aruch. What's the halacha? And then what does the Magen Avraham say the halacha is? Or what does the Magen Avraham even mean? And you go to the super commentary to understand what the Magen Avraham said the Shulchan Aruch means, right? And it becomes a much more elaborate process. But again, in so many facets of things that go on every day in our Jewish lives, we rely upon the writings of the Magen Avraham. And I hope this, actually somebody wrote a little piece of their dissertation on the Magen Avraham, and he mentioned to me, I wrote to him and said, are you going to publish this? He said he's going to work on it. So maybe one day in the not too distant future, we'll have more scholarship, which is certainly deserved and needed with respect to the life and contributions of the Magen Avraham. Let me pause there and ask if there are any questions before I jump to the test.
I have a quick question.
Please.
I'm just curious, in terms of his Kabbalistic leanings, is it Lurianic? Is it Sabbatean? I mean, where does he derive it from?
Yes, that's a good question. It's a little eclectic, but my recollection is that it's mostly Lurianic. Lurianic Kabbalah is the principal form of Kabbalah of Polish Jewry in the 17th century. And we'll circle back to Shabtai Tzvi in the next section of this discussion. Okay. Now I want to back up just a drop to talk about the Taz, a man by the name of Rabbi David ben Shmuel Halevi, or David ben Shmuel Siegel. So maybe we have some members of the shul related to the Taz. I'm saying we're backing up just a drop, because the Taz actually lives quite a long time. He's born in 1586 and he dies in 1667. Okay. And by the time we're talking about the Magen Avraham, the time we're talking about the Shach, the Taz is the Gadol Hador. He's the sort of undisputed elder statesman of Polish Jewry, of Ashkenazic Jewry. He's born in Ukraine in, as I said, 1586. And again, unlike the Magen Avraham, he's born into a prominent family, renowned for wealth and scholarship, and this, you know, leads to a very different trajectory. He marries the daughter of the Bach. Okay, who is also, we didn't discuss him in this series, although we could have. He wrote one of the most important commentaries to the Torah, Rabbi Yoel Sirkis. Okay. So he's got the yichus, and he has the lineage, and he has the wealth, and all of these conspire to place the Taz at the top of the Jewish scholarly world. Okay, he lived for a time in Krakow. He spent more than 20 years in a prestigious rabbinic post in Poznan. Posen, I think, is the contemporary name of that area in present-day Poland. And again, you can't escape these dates, 1648, 1649, you have the Chmelnytsky massacres. So everything is uprooted and he has to flee. He ends up wandering around Moravia for a time and he spends the last years of his life in Lvov. Okay, present day Lvov, right? Lemberg was known for a time, but we're back to present day Ukraine. That's where he started and ended his life. So let me say a word just about the Chmelnytsky massacres. You know, if you ever have a little time on Tisha B'Av, so we spend a lot of time reading and writing and talking about the Holocaust, as well we should. Before the 20th century, Chmelnytsky, 1648-1649, was the most heinous, atrocity of the last, 500, maybe 1,000 years. We've revised our scholarship on the number of Jews who were murdered during the Chmelnytsky massacre. They used to say it was 1 million. They used to say it's 500,000. We don't know the number. It's a big number. It's probably a six-figure number. And I'll just say, ever so briefly, we have firsthand accounts. We have firsthand accounts of these massacres. Okay, and again, because we have the atrocities of the 20th century, these unspeakable acts became speakable, and like we read about them, we know people who saw them, and we know survivors. But in their time, I mean, unspeakable acts. It wasn't just that they murdered Jews, but they raped and they pillaged and they tortured, and just unspeakable atrocities that were committed. And there's an epilogue to the Chmelnytsky massacres, which is they precipitated a refugee crisis. So there's X number of people who were murdered and killed. But how many more people were displaced or enslaved or sold or uprooted? There's actually a wonderful book that came out just a few years ago by a terrific scholar named Adam Teller. The book is called Rescue the Surviving Souls, and it's functionally a description of the refugee crisis precipitated by these massacres in the 17th century. So the Taz is living through these moments, and he actually wrote Kinos. We have them. I don't think they made it into the Tisha B'Av Kinos book, but you could look them up. You could find them. He wrote Kinos to capture the brutality of these terrible times through which he lived. The second cataclysm is, of course, the story of Shabtai Tzvi, which is a long story. But you know that in 1666, Shabtai Tzvi declared himself the Messiah. And in 1667, he apostatized and converted to Islam. So what was the rabbinic reaction to Shabtai Tzvi? All these people, the Magen Avraham and the Taz and the Shach and all of their students and all of their families, they're all living through this moment. So did they believe in Shabtai Tzvi? Did they oppose Shabtai Tzvi? What was their reaction to Shabtai Tzvi? So as it turns out, the historical record is kind of like wiped clean. Okay, as Gershom Scholem puts it, you know, it was like an embarrassment for the Jewish community. Nobody wanted to talk about it, and they just wanted to move on. So we don't have a lot of information about how the Shachs and Tazes and Magen Avrams of the world actually responded to this life-altering event. We do have one stunning document which tells us a story, and I have it for you. You could look in source number 5. If you have Gershom Scholem's Shabtai Tzvi, the Mystical Messiah, if you have a couple of weeks, 1,000 pages, you can read the whole thing. But 623 to 625, you can find this. You can find this story, and I'll just summarize it for you. The story that we have, or as much as we know, is that after Shabtai Tzvi had declared, he's in the Ottoman Empire, he's imprisoned in Gallipoli. After he declared his messiahship, so the Taz sent his son and his stepson from Poland to investigate. Okay. The whole world is like taken up by this messianic fervor, and the Taz is the Gadol Hador, what he wants to form an opinion. It should be an informed opinion. So he sends this, he dispatches these emissaries, his son and his stepson, to go check out what is happening in Gallipoli. Is this the real deal? And we have this firsthand account of these two rabbinic scholars, son and stepson of the Taz, who meet with Shabtai Tzvi, and a record of their conversation and their discussion and their reaction. There is no question that these two emissaries are very taken by Shabtai Tzvi. What we don't have is the Taz's reaction. Okay, they come back and report what they saw and how taken they are with Shabtai Tzvi, this magnetic personality. You know, it was all about the suffering of the Polish people. You know, it was all about the Taz. And they're taken with him. How does the Taz respond? We're not sure. We don't have that piece of the story. Gershom Shalom surmises that, if the emissaries were taken, the Taz was taken too. Some people come along and say, no, it can't be. The Taz was the Gadol Hador. How could it possibly be that he believed in a false Messiah? It can't possibly be. So I'll tell you a secret. And the secret is that it would be almost unthinkable that anyone didn't believe in Shabtai Tzvi. How many rabbis can you name from 1666 who stood up and said, not him, let's stop the presses. He's a fake-o. It's not the real thing. How many rabbis can you name? Maybe one. Okay, there's a man called Yaakov Sasportas, wonderful book that just came out, published a couple years ago, Dissident Rabbi Yaakov Dweck, Princeton University Press, a masterful book about Yaakov Sasportas and his opposition. He wasn't even an opponent. He just said, everyone is so sure. How can you be so sure? I'm not so sure. He just introduced doubt into the conversation about Shabtai Tzvi. So all of this is a long-winded way of saying it would be shocking if any rabbi in Poland in 1666 didn't believe in Shabtai Tzvi. The world was overcome, Ashkenazim, Sephardim, almost no exceptions. Now, a year later, Shabtai Tzvi apostatizes, converts to Islam, and lives another 9 years until his passing in 1676. What happens then is that the overwhelming majority of the Jewish world says, oh my gosh, we got it wrong, we blew it, it's not our guy, and they reverted to their normal non-messianic Jewish lives. There was a minority that continued to believe. There was a minority that even converted to Islam to follow their Messiah. Okay, so that's heretical and deeply problematic, and right, we could talk a lot about that minority. But the whole Jewish world for a short time was gripped by this messianic fervor. So presumably the Taz was gripped by the same messianic fervor. It doesn't change our opinion of the Taz or anyone, right? Because again, the whole world had been duped. It was only that minority that continued to subscribe to heretical beliefs in the Messiah after his conversion that already becomes suspicious, problematic, and heretical. But for the majority of the Jewish world that believed for a short time, right? What more could we expect? Everyone believed. Okay. So let me just say a couple words about the Taz's commentary to Shulchan Aruch. Unlike the Magen Avraham, the Taz wrote a commentary to all four books of Shulchan Aruch: Orach Chaim, Choshen Mishpat, Eben Ezer, and Yoredeya. Okay, he began with Yoredeya, which was published in 1646. The rest of his commentary circulated in manuscript and were only published posthumously. And it actually took some decades before some of those commentaries were finally published. In source number six, I have a relatively contemporary Israeli scholar who just sort of characterizes the commentary of the Taz. And he writes that, you know, at the end of the day, you shouldn't think of the Taz as a commentary, as a strict commentator to the Shulchan Aruch. You know, you think of a commentator, so you think, you know, here's the Gemara and here's Rashi, and Rashi explains what the Gemara is saying. He says, you know, the Taz doesn't function that way. He's not saying, oh, this is, let me tell you what the tool, what the Shulchan Aruch really, really means. What he's doing is kind of explaining and expanding the orbit of the Shulchan Aruch. And he says, you should think of the Taz more as like a study aid to the Shulchan Aruch. So if you're interested in knowing something beyond what the Shulchan Aruch is saying, some of the sources, what does the Torah say, you know, how do you respond to questions that might come up that people have asked about this particular sugya? So you can go to the Taz and he'll discuss many of those issues. Unlike the Magen Avraham, right? He, not only is he not succinct, but he's, you know, what's the word? Prolix. Right. And sometimes he'll get off on a tangent and he'll write a whole essay on a particular topic, which is only tangentially related to what the Shulchan Aruch is telling you. And so there's some unevenness when you have the two sides of the page. Sometimes you have the Shach and the Taz, sometimes you have the Magen Avraham and the Taz. And the Taz, you know, takes up like three quarters of the space because he writes in such an expansive manner. Because he was the Gadol HaDor, he was really considered to be decisive in his time. And when we come back to the Shach, so we'll just think a little bit about what happened between the Shach and the Taz. So I'll just conclude with one excerpt from a doctoral dissertation. Again, the Magen Avraham suffers from a little bit of this same phenomenon, which is a disconnect between, wow, you had the Gadol HaDor, the Taz, outsized influence in the course of Jewish history, and where's the definitive biography of this man? And we don't really have it. There's a couple, a book here and a book there that are not particularly, you know, well accepted by the scholarly community. So we're still waiting for a more authoritative book on the Taz. But there was a student at Yeshiva University who earns his PhD in 1948 by the name of Noah Rosenblum, and he actually published the dissertation later on in life. But I'll just share with you one excerpt from his dissertation, and just say one word about it. You have it in source number seven. He writes, "The 17th century was one of the most cataclysmic centuries in the history of the Jewish community of Poland. Chmielnytsky rebellion erupted like a dormant volcano and threatened the very foundations of Polish Jewry. On the threshold of this eventful century, Reb David Halevi, the Taz, appeared, unable to stem the gushing lava of barbarism that seemed to engulf his brethren. He decided to resume the latter, to rescue rather the latter from social and religious disintegration. Laboring patiently, persistently, and systematically, ever his commentary to Rezav on the Shulchan Aruch, he endeavored to enhance the authority and prestige of the latter and contributed greatly to make it the standard code of Israel." And again, that's what happens. And I'm going to keep coming back to that. But because people like the Magen Avraham and the Taz attached their commentaries to the Shulchan Aruch, so it elevated the status of the Shulchan Aruch and made it even more singular. Aided by the commentary of Reb David, the Shulchan Aruch shone forward as a beacon of light to the remnants of a devastated Polish Jewry emerging from the ruins of the Chmielnytsky pogroms. It shed light in the esoteric confusion caused by the pseudo-messianic movement of Shabtai Tzvi and pointed for future generations to a perplexed mankind the straight path to God's holy mountain. Okay, so it's very beautiful and poetic. I'll just make one comment, which is, by the time the Chmielnytsky massacres occurred, right, the Taz was already in retirement age. By the time Shabtai Tzvi professed his messiahship, so he was already at the very end of his life. It was the year before he died. So he didn't write his commentaries with the hope of, you know, giving comfort and direction to a people who had suffered these cataclysms. It may have worked out that way. Okay, but he didn't write his commentaries with those intentions. He wrote his commentary, actually published his commentary to Yerodea in 1646, 2 years before Chmielnytsky, in a relatively, you know, I don't say peaceful world, but at a time when, you know, things were less bad than they were in the succeeding decade. So let me pause here and ask if there are any questions or comments before I round things out with the Shach. Okay, so We're going to move now geographically a little away from Poland. The Shach is the shorthand version of a book called the Sifsei Kohen, written by a man called Shabtai HaKohen, who was born in around 1621 and lived a very short life. He accomplished a great deal, but died at the age of 41 in 1662. So I actually misspoke when I said, you know, the Shach would have been around for Shabtai Tzvi. It's not true. He died actually before Shabtai Tzvi's messiahship. Okay, so the Shach is born in 1621 and dies in 1662. His grandparents lived in Germany. His parents lived in Poland, but he spent the better part of his life in Lithuania. Okay, so there's an Eastern trajectory in the family of the Shach. Okay, like the Taz, he has a kind of prominent and wealthy lineage. There's even some family tree somewhere where you can say that the Shach married the great granddaughter of the Rama. Something, there's some connection there. I'm not sure if it's ever been firmly established. Okay, so. After again, not too much biographical information on the Shach, but he was a prominent rabbi in Lithuania and ended up living in Halyshaw, which is in Moravia, toward the end of his life. There's one letter it's quite obscure. It was published in a journal in 1830. And I just share it with you because I think it's fascinating, and I think it actually is telling. You have it in source number 8. Still waiting for someone to write something about this letter. So in source number 8, I have a letter. We have a version that's in Hebrew, and I suspect it actually was written in Hebrew because it's not a translation. Meaning, this is verses and psukim that rhyme and run together. It would be hard to imagine this is a translation. This is probably the original letter, and it was written. And you can see it was written February 1660. It's dated, and it's addressed to a man. The top line here: Hafilosof Magister Valentini Vidrich. Okay, so I actually wrote to the University of Leipzig because this guy, it sounds like, was a professor at the University of Leipzig. So I wrote to the national, it's not a national, I wrote to the city University Leipzig library and said, you ever hear of a doctor, professor by the name of Valentini Vidrich, and can you tell me anything about him? I'm waiting to hear back. If I find out, I'll let you know. Okay, but fascinating that that the Shach has a correspondence with clearly non-Jewish university professor in Leipzig. What's the correspondence? So, as best I could tell, and it's a challenging letter to decipher. But it seems like this fellow, Valentini Vidrich, asked the Shach to procure for him a book. So the Shach writes back and said, I'm so happy to receive your letter, and I'm sending you warm regards, and I'm sending you the book. And the book he names, it's a book called Habachur, which is a book of Hebrew grammar. And presumably the person he's writing to is a Hebraist who's interested in Hebrew grammar. He's writing this letter in Hebrew, so the recipient either can read it or can find someone who can translate it for him. And then I'll just share with you this line, which is really amazing. If you can see it on the screen here, this is source number 8. He says, V'af gam zos eseh la'ava, out of great love, I'll do the following. Adoni, La'avas Aduni, out of my love for you, ki vakesh mimenu liknos lo eze sefer, because you've asked me to buy for you a particular book. So he says, yishlach li hamaus al yidei chiluf lebreslau. I want you to send I think it means a bill of exchange, right? Which would have been a kind of, we don't really have bills of exchange anymore, but it's something akin to like a cross between a money order and a check. Send payments through Breslau, which happens to be midway between Halleschau and Leipzig, or thereabouts. Kisham or Vrim Beshavim Bitzmidus, there's lots of traffic there. Anche Iri, Anche Midos. And there's people from my city, maybe business people, I don't know really what he means, but Anche Midos, who would be able to handle this transaction. You'll get me the money and I'll get you the book. Beknelo, as Asher Yodienu, what you let me know, I'll be happy to buy the book. And he says, with God's help, it's so such a firm formulation, I'll be happy to get this book for you. So I just bring this up, because it's fascinating to know that someone like the Shach, who we're imagining living in a shtetl, in a ghetto in Lithuania, is corresponding with a university professor, in Leipzig. So it's stunning just to recognize that there's that, breadth going on in 1660. But what I think is equally fascinating is the university professor in Leipzig is asking the Shach for a book. Right, it should be the opposite. Like he should have access. The university professor should have access to everything, and the guy in the shtetl should be asking him, like, "Well, can you open my eyes?" No, the guy from Leipzig is writing to Halleschau, right, for the Shach's help in procuring a book. Who knows, what kind of book? But it just opens up, and this is where I want to go with you. The opposite of the Magen Avraham, who didn't have two pennies to his name and didn't have access to primary sources, the Shach had access to everything. And his commentary to the Shulchan Aruch is like a Beis Yosef on steroids. So remember, we read the introduction to the Beis Yosef. And the Beis Yosef says, I'm going to quote, and he says these 32 sources, and it was amazing because he had mastery over the entire canon of, early Rishonim, and he synthesized them. It's stunning. So now, okay, we're 100 years later, and printing is off the charts, and hundreds of Jewish texts have been printed, some of them multiple times, and the Shach has all of them and knows all of them and synthesizes all of them. So sometimes it's just jaw-dropping to read his commentary and to think, like, he didn't have a Bar Ilan CD-ROM, like he didn't have the internet. He just had his own intellectual capacities, and the guy died at 41, and this is what he's able to produced. There's like nothing that wasn't known to him. So it's staggering to read his commentary. I have for you in source number 9, and again, this is the Chidah, okay, the Chidah who we've mentioned in the past with Chaim Yosef David Azulai, who lives in the following century and writes an encyclopedia of Jewish personalities and Jewish books. And he says, and let me just tell you about the Shach. I have a Masor about the Shach. And he says, "Veshamati, source number 9, Mirav Echad Sharav Shach Hayo Yodea Shem Hametzia." I know what that means, but in the context, you can understand what it means. He says, "I once heard about the Shach that he had some like Kabbalistic mystical power that he knew the Shem Hametzia." What does that mean? "Dehainu Shem Kadosh, there's some name of Hashem Lachavein Bo V'Limtzo HaBekius Sharotzei Tekef Miad, where he could just like you say that magic, abracadabra, and poof." You can call up any Jewish source that's ever been written. Okay. So the Chidah's explanation, right, the only way to explain the staggering breadth of the Shach's library was to say it was like a superhuman power, right? Because in human terms, there's just no way to explain it. Okay. And that's the extraordinary quality of the Shach. Rabbi Ezra Schwartz, Rosh Hashiva at Yeshiva University, makes a fascinating point. He says, even before the Vilna Gaon popularized this method of scholarship, the Shach was already basically doing textual emendations. Says, I have two versions of this book, and this one cited X and this one cited Y. And so this is the reason why the first one must be more accurate and the next one must be a mistake. Rabbi Schwartz says he counted 800 times in the commentary of the Shach that he uses the word ta'usu. It's a mistake. You don't find that in the Taz, right? That's just not what the Taz is interested in. But the Shach will tell you 800 times, no, that's a mistake. And actually, I figured it out because I have the entire Jewish library and Jewish canon in front of me and at my fingertips. And I can tell you which is the most accurate source. Apparently, he actually wrote commentaries to all four books of the Shulchan Aruch, like the Taz. The only ones that survive are his commentaries to Yoredeya and Choshen Mishpat. Okay, and of course, you know that the Shulchan Aruch is printed on Yoredeya and Choshen Mishpat with the commentaries of the Shach Zedbar. But on Yoredeya, you have the Shach and the Taz side by side. So let me just say two words about the reception history of the Shach. Remember, the Taz is the Gadol Hador, and he's already in 1646 published his commentary to Yoredeya. In the very same year, 25-year-old Shabtai Katz, publishes his competing commentary to the Shulchan Aruch's Yoredeya. So he gathers haskamas. Okay, haskama is an approbation which usually appears at the front of the book. And if you want people to buy your book, we do the same thing today. So, you know, there's a blurb or there's, somebody has a nice thing to say. Maybe they haven't heard of the author, but they heard of the guy who reviewed it, the woman who reviewed it. And you say, oh, well, if they think it's good, maybe I'm. Okay, so haskamas were very common. You have two, you have three, you have four, you have five. He writes, collects 18 haskamos from, again, all of these contemporary gedolim, and he puts them at the front of his book so that everyone will know. I may look like a kid, 25, I'm a little upstart, but I'm just telling you, everyone knows that this is the real deal. And he articulated himself with a great deal of confidence and self-confidence. And as one can imagine, this generated not a small amount of controversy. You can imagine people saying, like, you can't just mess with the Taz. The Taz is the Gadol Hador. And the Shach said, well, I'm only messing with him because he's wrong. So it's fine. Okay, so I'm exaggerating, but again, only a little. The Taz responded. After he saw the Shach's commentary, and without naming the Shach, he said, you know, these questions or issues have been raised, and he writes something called the Daf Acharon to respond to the Shach, and then the Shach writes a whole new book to respond to the Taz. Okay, and they go back and forth. And I'll just share with you. I have this. It's actually not on your source sheet, but I'll put it up on the screen as source number 10 in his introduction to the Nekudas HaKesef. The Shach writes the following. Again, upstart Shach, Gadol Hador is the Taz, and he says, and they're fighting with each other. He says, Amar Machaber Aya Le'alev Hakara B'Sifrizeh Shebipnei Shaya Lichas V'Shalom Eze Machlokes Im Baal Torei Zahav. If you're reading this, don't think that it's because I have some, you know, bone to pick with the Taz, the Gadol Hador. It's not true. Oh, Yeshli B'Libi Ezo Tina Lab Chibarti Hasagos Al Sifro. He says, because I had some objection to him, that's why I wrote a book that's so opposed to him. It's not true. Ki halo noda lakol. Everybody knows. Kiniskaimu banu at v'hav b'sufa v'hatora machzeres acher achsanya shelash asisi achsanya l'habal turezav hayatzli shlosh layamin. We have this great relationship with each other, and I actually hosted him for 3 days, v'chibativ, and I gave him all kinds of kavod gadol, asher lo yuman, which is unbelievable, ki yusupar v'gam hu nichspad bi, and he also had great respect for me, arba ad shenashkeni al rashi, he kissed me, v'samach bi mamash. We love each other. So at some point, what does Shakespeare say? Like, the lady doth protest too much, you correct my Shakespeare. But it's a problem. Okay, if you have to go that far to say, no, really, we love each other and we get along so beautifully and famously, and we, so there was an underlying tension, and of course we can understand it because the stakes were so high. Everyone is trying to understand, you know, what the conclusion of the story is, what the Shulchan Aruch says, and what's the final psak. So, you know, who had the final word in 1683? The Council of the Four Lands, the Vad Arba Aretzot, actually ruled that in a machlokas between the Shach and the Taz, the halacha follows the Taz. What ended up happening was certainly in Germany, Germany, the Taz was followed. But over time, most Polish poskim ended up following the Shach. And certainly by the 19th, 20th, 21st century, the Shach has really become totally predominant. It's not to say there aren't times when we care deeply about the position of the Taz, but you know, pound for pound, more often than not, it's the position of the Shach that gets followed. So let me pause here and ask if there are any questions. And if not, we'll spend our final 6 minutes just looking at a couple examples. I'm sorry, you know, again, maybe this was too ambitious, but I just want to give you a quick excerpt from the Taz and a quick excerpt from the Magen Avraham. We'll save the Shach for another time because, again, the Shach didn't write a commentary, or if he did, it was lost to Orach Chaim. So we've been learning these halachos from Hilchos Chanukah. Let me just pull up a couple quickies on the screen to leave you with a couple nuggets. You can use these at your Chanukah table. So there is a halacha. The Shulchan Aruch writes in source number 11, Ribu ha-sudas shemarbin behem heim sudas ha-reshus shelo kava'um l'mishteh v'simcha. It's not really a mitzvah to have a Chanukah suda, the Shulchan Aruch says. It's not a mitzvah to have a Chanukah suda. You could, there's no special obligation. The Ramah writes, V'yashem shish k'tzas mitzvah b'ribu ha-sudas mishum d'v'osar yamim haim ha-chanukah s'mizbeach. You know, there was the Chanukah Samizbeach, there was the rededication of the temple, and so you do a little more. It's not a Suda, but it shouldn't just be an average dinner on Tuesday night. It's Chanukah, do something a little special. Okay. So the Taz says, let me just explain to you why that would be. Why is there no Chanukah Suda? Don't you have a Purim Suda? So he says, Shalok kva'um l'mishteh b'simcha perish el l'halal l'hodos. These are days of Halel and Hodah. The Nira Hatam, why? You've heard this before, but maybe not from the Taz. Delo kavu kan l'simcha kemo b'purim. De purim haya anes mufursam latzalus nefashos. Vayidei valze yesh simcha ba'olam hazeh. He says the Purim was a physical salvation, right? Our lives were on the line. We were saved. And so we celebrate with a much more physical celebration. And we have, right, gashmiistic celebration ba'olam hazeh with a suda. Masha ain't came to Chanukah, as opposed to Chanukah, the Avagav to Haisa Yeshua Mimenu Yisparach Bimelchama Mikamakom Lo Yam Mefursam Hanes Rak Beneros. Right, the open miracle, the Nes Nigla, when it came to Chanukah, it's true there was a military victory, but when we really celebrate is the spiritual victory, which is commemorated by the candles, and so there's not a physical manifestation of our celebration the same way that there is on Purim. It's a spiritual salvation, and so it's a spiritual celebration. That's a kind of snippet from the Taz on Hilchos Chanukah, and a snippet from the Magen Avraham in source 13. The Shulchan Aruch writes, "Here's the halacha: Shachach ohezid velohidlik im shkiyas achama madlik vaholech ad shetichla regal min hashuk." Okay, so everyone knows this halacha. You're supposed to light it tzeis hakochavim, but didn't happen. Something happened. It got later. So what do? You could light as long as people are still going through the street. Kimo chatzi shah, sha'azam over in Vishavim v'ikur pesuminisa, because that half an hour after dark, people are still milling about and they're on the street and they'll see the candles that you light at the doorway or at the windowsill, and that'll be pesuminisa, so that's totally fine. Helkach tzarach litein v'ashem en kazeh hashir. And so that's why you always need to make sure, if you read any little guide to Chanukah, make sure there's enough oil that's going to burn for half an hour. Vim Nasan by Yoser, and if you put in more than half an hour's worth of fuel, Yachol Lechabosel Achar She'avar Zazman, you could just put out the candles after 30 minutes. If you want to preserve oil, you're running out, whatever the case may be, it's totally fine. It only needs to burn for 30 minutes. V'chein Yachol Yishtamesh La'or Lachar Zazman. We don't necessarily teach this to the kids because it's hard to make this subtle distinction, but principally, after the candles have burned for 30 minutes, you could do whatever you want with them because, you know, now it's open season. The candles are technically not being used for a mitzvah anymore. What does the Magen Avraham jump in and say? Fascinating. You may not have heard this one before. He says, "V'nirali devadai b'ner shel shema ein hider mitzvah bein rab lemat." He says, you know, you light a Hanukkah candle, you light a menorah with oil. He says, you put in a little, you put in a lot, it doesn't matter. I'm not moved. There's no hider mitzvah, whether, you know, it's burning for 30 minutes or for 3 hours. It doesn't move me. Alva b'neiros shava, but if you're using wax candles, k'shehem arukim heim na'im yoser k'mo b'neiros yom ha-kippurim v'lulav esrek v'chayotzi bo v'chimedume li shekem kasu b'kalbo. He says, I actually think I have it on earlier authority that there's a difference between wax and oil. When it comes to oil, you're not going to be able to do any hider mitzvah because it looks the way it looks and it lasts as long as it lasts. But with candles, you have tall candles and they're all symmetrical and they're nice and long. So, and you light them, that's a real hider mitzvah. As opposed to using, you know, little tiny stubs of candles, right? That doesn't really do it. So he says the only way to actually, you know, create more hider mitzvah by having, you know, the lights burn longer is if you use wax as opposed to if you use oil. Totally counterintuitive. We always think, oh, oil is so much better. The nace was performed with oil. You should. And again, we looked a few weeks ago at the Ramah who says no, but in Krakow we all use wax. So the Magen Avraham pours on, forgive the pun, and says that you could actually get an added bonus of hider mitzvah by using long candles, even though you could never accomplish that that same ethic by using more oil. Okay, obviously, there's a ton more to talk about with respect to these three luminaries, the Shachtaz and the Magen Avraham. But I hope that at least when we hear these names, we'll be able to attach a little more identity to each of them. You know, the world could have actually been very different if these giants of Torah, you know, had written texts or written books of other kinds. So, you know, we would have had them, and we would have studied them. But their choice to attach their commentaries to the Shulchan Aruch cemented the Shulchan Aruch as the central and principal halachic text for all time, right? Maybe there was a moment when it was a little up in the air and there was some controversy, but when the Shach and the Taz and the Magen Avraham, you know, they're like, they all bought in. Right? The fact that they wrote their commentaries to the Shulchan Aruch was the premier indication that, you know, we consider this to be the central text and all discussions should begin and end here. And, you know, as a result, their commentaries generated further commentaries, and hundreds of years hence, right, they're still generating further discussion and further commentaries. And so there is now, you know, no question that the Shulchan Aruch, along with the Ramah and the Nosei Kelim, there's no question that it occupies this central role and this decisive voice in the halachic discourse. Please, God, we'll pick up here next time with the Shulchan Aruch HaRav and Reb Shneur Zalman of Liadi, the first Lubavitcher Rebbe. I'm going to stop the recording now, but happy to stay on for a few minutes to field any questions or comments.